Stalin ordered Malenkov and Abakumov to put together the Jewish case. Since its centerpiece was the plan for the Jewish Crimea, on the 13th of January 1949, Malenkov summoned Lazovsky, ex-overlord of the Jewish Committee, for an interrogation. As many as 110 prisoners, most of them Jews, were suffering French wrestling in the Lubyanka at the hands of Komarov, a vicious anti-Semite psychopath. "I was merciless with them," boasted Komarov later. "I tore their souls apart. The minister himself didn't scare them as much as me. I was especially pitiless with the Jewish nationalists." Paulina was expelled from the party for close relations with Jewish nationalists, despite being warned in 1939 when Molotov had abstained on a similar vote. Now, remarkably, he abstained again, but sensing the gravity of the case, he buckled. "I abstained, which I acknowledge to be politically incorrect," he wrote to Stalin on the 20th of January 1949. "I hereby declare that after thinking the matter over, I now vote in favour. I acknowledge I was gravely at fault in not restraining in time a person close to me from taking false steps and from dealings with such anti-Soviet nationalists as Mikhoels." On the 21st of January, Paulina was arrested in her squirrel fur coat. Her sisters, doctor and secretaries, were arrested. One of her sisters and a brother would die in prison. Her arrest was ominous for other leaders, who secretly sympathized with her. Paulina, who was not tortured, denied everything. She continued to play the grande dame in the netherworld. Another prisoner heard her shouting, "Phone my husband. Tell him to send my diabetes pills. I'm an invalid. You've no right to feed me this rubbish." No one heard anything more of Paulina. Many believed she was dead, but Beria knew better. "Paulina's alive," he whispered to Molotov at Politburo meetings. Stalin and Abakumov discussed whether to make her the leading defendant in their Jewish trial, but then decided Lazovsky would be the star. Paulina was sentenced to 5 years in exile, a mild sentence, considering the fates of her co-prisoners. "You need 3 things in prison," she told her daughters later. "Soap to keep you clean, bread to keep you fed, onions to keep you well." Ironically, she was befriended by some deported kulaks, so that the innocent peasants, whom she and her husband had been so keen to liquidate, were the kind strangers who saved her life. She never stopped loving Molotov. During her imprisonment, she wrote, "Only the thought of you forces me to live, and the knowledge that you may still need the remnants of my tormented heart and the whole of my huge love for you." Molotov never stopped loving her. Touchingly, he ordered his maids to lay a place for her at table every evening as he ate alone, aware that she suffered because of me. Stalin now excluded Molotov from the highest echelons, scrawling that documents should not be signed by Comrade Molotov who doesn't participate in the work of the Bureau of the Council of Ministers. Stalin still trusted Mikoyan just enough to send the worldly Armenian on a secret mission to size up Mao Zedong, who was about to complete his conquest of China. On the 31st of January 1949, in great secrecy, Mikoyan reached Mao's headquarters, where he met Mao and Chou Enlai, and presented Stalin's gifts. One present was typically venomous: the information that an American at Mao's court was a spy and should be arrested. The visit was a success, even though Mikoyan admitted that he had hoped for a rest from Stalin's nocturnal habits, only to find that Mao kept the same hours. On his return, Mikoyan found a shock awaiting him. Stalin sacked Molotov and Mikoyan as foreign and foreign trade ministers, though both remained deputy premiers. Then he accused Mikoyan of breaking official secrecy about his Chinese trip. Mikoyan had only told his son Stepan, but Stepan had mentioned it to Svetlana. An innocent comment by Svetlana to her father had endangered the Mikoyans. Stalin had not forgotten the arrest of Mikoyan's children in 1943. They were still under surveillance. "What happened to your children who were arrested?" Stalin suddenly asked Mikoyan ominously. "Do you think they deserve the right to study at Soviet institutions?" Mikoyan carefully did not reply, but he understood the threat, particularly after Paulina's arrest. Stalin started to mutter that Voroshilov was an English spy, and hardly saw him while the diminished Molotov and Mikoyan just hung on. Now Stalin's chosen successors succumbed to the brutal vendetta by Beria and Malenkov. Stalin's heir apparent as premier, Nikolai Voznesensky, was at 44 the youngest Politburo member and a brilliant planner, who enjoyed an unusually honest relationship with Stalin. However, this made him so brash that he didn't bother to hide his moods or his strident Russian nationalism. Rude to his colleagues, no one made so many enemies as Voznesensky. Now his patron, Zhdanov, was dead. His enemy, Malenkov, resurgent. Voznesensky's arrogance and Stalin's touchiness made him vulnerable. During 1948, Stalin noticed that production rose in the last quarter of the year but dipped in the first quarter. This was a normal seasonal variation, but Stalin asked Voznesensky to level it out. Voznesensky promised he would. However, he failed to do so, and, afraid of Stalin, he concealed the statistics. Somehow this legerdemain was leaked to Beria, who discovered that hundreds of documents had gone missing. One night at Kuntsevo, Beria sprung it on Stalin, who, observed Mikoyan, was astonished, then furious. "Does it mean Voznesensky deceives the Politburo and tricks us like fools?" Beria then revealed the damning secret about Voznesensky that he had treasured ever since 1941. During Stalin's breakdown, Voznesensky had told Molotov, "Vyacheslav, go forward. We'll follow you." That betrayal clinched it. Sacked from the Politburo, he spent his days at home, writing an economics treatise. The other anointed heir was Kuznetsov, who had helped Zhdanov remove Malenkov in 1946 and replaced Beria as curator of the MGB, thus earning their hatred. Sincere and affable, Kuznetsov was the opposite of Voznesensky. Virtually everyone liked him, but decency was relative at Stalin's court. Kuznetsov had aided Zhdanov in anti-Semitic matters and forwarded Stalin a report on the sexual peccadilloes of party officials. He worshipped Stalin, yet he did not understand him. He made the mistake of examining old MGB files on Kirov's murder and the show trials. Blundering into such sensitive matters aroused Stalin's suspicions. Malenkov alerted Stalin that the Leningrad party had covered up a voting scandal and held a trade fair without government permission. He managed to connect these sins with a vague plan mooted by Zhdanov to create a Russian, as opposed to a Soviet, party alongside the Soviet one, and make Leningrad the Russian capital. Malenkov had shrewdly amassed a collage of mistakes that touched all Stalin's sensitive places. "Go there and take a look at what's going on," Stalin ordered Malenkov and Abakumov, who arrived in Leningrad with two trains carrying 500 MGB officers and 20 investigators. "When Stalin orders him to kill one," Beria said, "Malenkov kills 1,000. Malenkov attacked the local bosses, stringing together disparate strands into one lethal conspiracy. The arrests began, but Voznesensky and Kuznetsov lingered at their flats in the pink Granovsky block, convinced that Stalin would forgive them.